Thanks for tuning in to the Next Level Church podcast. If you've never attended in person, we'd love to have you join us on Sunday mornings at 9:30 or 11:05 at 3105 Hampton Highway in Yorktown, Virginia. For more information, check out our website at nextlevelchurch.net.
Good morning. Very excited for you to be here today. Before we dive into things, I need to take care of something. This is some Airwick. It says that one spray will fill the room. It's a little funky in here today. Just gonna let that help us out. In case you're new and you're thinking that we're a very strange, weird occult that doesn't wear shoes, please know that this is a one-time thing, and you're welcome to keep your shoes on. But this is a barefoot Sunday is for us. It's a special Sunday, and I'm gonna tell you a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. But before we dive into that, I want to make sure that you guys know about something we do each and every week. That we partner with a free app called YouVersion, and it's a chance for you to dig in a little bit deeper with what you're about to hear. All the scriptures that I'm about to go over are in there. There's also a place for you to give prayer requests. There's a question of the week, so go ahead. If you're new, you can follow the steps up there. If you're a regular attender, then go ahead and open up your tablet or smartphone and check out YouVersion. Today, I am really excited about Barefoot Sunday, and the reason that we aren't wearing shoes is to raise awareness to a serious cause, that there are 1.8 million people in the world today that don't have shoes, a single pair of shoes. Out of that, 400 million are children. So let that number sink in for just a second. Now, for us, we're just trying to raise awareness and experience what literally billions experience every day. We're just trying to do it for an hour on Sunday in a building that has air conditioning, that cleans its floors, and has carpet most of the places. This is not bad for us. The only place that I'll really admit that is really sketchy, I am really weirded out by walking into the restroom with no shoes on, and I brought flip-flops just to help out my nerves. I'm a little bit of a germaphobe. But besides that, everything else it's not that difficult on us. But out of the millions who are barefoot, many of them have to travel a mile by foot just to get clean water. And they get clean water, and then they have to walk a mile back. And there are tons of diseases and deaths that happen simply because they hurt their foot, they injure their foot, something bites them, there is something that happens to their feet that causes them not to be able to go get water, which then in turn causes them not to be able to survive. Shoes is a huge thing. In fact, I didn't understand how big thing shoes were because my closet is filled with shoes, and it's something I take for granted. But there is a crazy stat. 1 million people are suffering from protoconiosis, a debilitating disease caused by walking barefoot in volcanic soil. Now, we don't even have volcanoes around here. That's not even on my radar. And if you were to ask me, are a million people affected by volcanic soot? I would say, no way. But yes, millions of people, literally, because their only way of getting around is by walking. They don't have cars, and they walk barefoot, and they walk through this, and they are literally debilitated simply from walking on the ground every single day. And so what we're doing is we're not just raising awareness by coming to church and stinking up the place one Sunday with no shoes on. We are also collecting shoes. And for the entire month, we've been collecting shoes, and we're partnering with a local organization called Thrive. And this is a really cool thing because this organization gives some of the shoes locally to people in need, to the homeless, to those that can't afford shoes, which is a great thing. But they also distribute the shoes that you guys have provided. They distribute those around the world. Now, this is something that it was new to me. I didn't understand how shoes going around the world could actually impact the world. But what they do is they do not give the shoes that you donated, they do not give those away around the world. They have found that in areas like Haiti that are incredibly impoverished, that when they dump a whole bunch of donations, it actually hurts their economy and it hurts people from the ability to work, that they just take the donations in and it doesn't actually help the economy to thrive. So what they do is they start micro businesses, and a micro business is just what it sounds like, a small business. And literally what they'll do with the shoes is they will give them to someone who sets up a table in front of their house, and they pile a stack of shoes on the table, and they sell the shoes, and then they make an income so that they can raise their family off the shoes that you've donated. Not only that, that income, now that they have money, can go back into the economy of the nation and is literally helping, it is helping hundreds of millions of people thrive just by donating shoes. Most of us gave shoes that we don't even wear anymore, and we didn't understand the global impact that our shoes are having. I think that this idea that there are literally 1.8 billion people who are affected without shoes, I think that's something that ticks Jesus off. I can't prove this. There's not a verse that says Jesus gets ticked off because there's 400 million kids without shoes. But I think that Jesus looks out, and when he sees us with having just closet full of shoes and just not even thinking about it, I think he says, you know what? You can do something about it. And so often in the church world, we always get concerned about God getting ticked off. And we always think that when God gets ticked off, it's about making a bad choice. It's about sinning. That God is out there. He's a cosmic watchdog who's watching every one of our actions. And if we don't obey him perfectly, then he gets ticked off at us. And we're in a series, we're continuing it today, how to tick off Jesus, or how to tick Jesus off. And last week we looked at an instance where Jesus met a woman who was caught in sin. And instead of throwing stones at her, instead of condemning her, he welcomed her with love and he embraced her and he gave her grace. So does Jesus like it when we sin? No. I think that it actually breaks Jesus' heart. Because when we sin, when we make a decision that is not honoring to God, it is hurting ourselves, it is hurting other people. But I don't think that Jesus is wagging a finger at us and he's ticked off when we make mistakes. I literally think he looks at us like you would look at your kid if they made a decision to hurt themselves, if they willingly hurt themselves, if they made a choice that was not in their best interest, it would break your heart. You'd say, "Ma, I wish you wouldn't have done that. That hurts you." And God, when he looks down, when Jesus looks down and sees our sin, I think his heart breaks. There are some things, though, that tick Jesus off. And today we're going to look at an instance of a time where Jesus got ticked off, but it wasn't because someone sinned. It wasn't because someone broke one of the Ten Commandments or did something that was just considered unholy. He gets ticked off at a group of people called the Pharisees. Dun, dun, dun. The Pharisees are a group of religious men that were constantly the antagonists to Jesus' story. And I want to give you a little bit of context about what we're going to read, because this is incredibly important to us, because if something ticks Jesus off, it should also tick off his followers. And we think that Jesus gets ticked off at sin, but last week we saw that Jesus didn't get ticked off at sin. He embraced sin and gave grace back. Today we're going to look at an instance where Jesus does get ticked off, and we need to ask ourselves, if that makes Jesus angry, shouldn't it make us angry as well? I want to give you a little bit of context about what we're about to read. This comes right after a time where Jesus is walking through a grain field. And as he's walking through the grain field, one of his disciples or a few of his disciples pull some of the grain and they eat it. Now, that doesn't seem like that big of a deal, right? No harm, no foul. They just ate some grain. But there are some Pharisees, these religious watchdogs, that are watching every action of Jesus. And they see his disciples tear some of the grain up and they get angry. They get indignant. And the reason is because you are not supposed to work on the Sabbath. Now, once we dive into our text, I'll explain the Sabbath a little bit more. But what you need to know is that they were not allowed to barely breathe on the Sabbath. And these Pharisees get angry at Jesus. And they say, why are you allowing your followers, your disciples, to break the Sabbath? And Jesus' response is amazing. Like, I would never want to get in an argument with Jesus. Like, he's amazing. Like, Jesus looks at him and he says, here's the deal, guys. David, the guy that you celebrate, King David, one of the most celebrated guys in our whole faith, he broke the same Sabbath rules that you did. He got food from the temple in order to meet his needs. And I just want to let you guys know this, that the Sabbath, what man wasn't made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man. Translation, I gave you the Sabbath as something to help you, not to be this weight that is upon you that you feel like you have to obey every little thing. I gave it to you to benefit you. Not only that, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. Drops the mic and then walks away. I mean, it's an incredible moment. Like, it's like, it shuts them up. They're like, whoa, he's the Lord of the Sabbath. Like, they didn't know what to do, but they get angry with Jesus. And that sets up our text for today. Let's dive into Mark chapter 3, verses 1 through 2. Another time, Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Now, this is building upon the story that I just told you about, that these religious leaders were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. And on the Sabbath day, he is met with a man with a shriveled hand. And the Pharisees know that Jesus has the ability to heal. Now, this brings up all sorts of warning signs, because they should have been concerned with, is this Jesus guy, this Messiah that we've been praying for and waiting for? Let's watch him closely to see if he does heal, because if he heals, maybe he's the one we've been waiting for and we should celebrate. But instead of being concerned with whether or not Jesus can or cannot do miracles, they just embrace, this dude does miracles. We're going to see if he does a miracle on our Sabbath. And if he does a miracle on our Sabbath, then we're going to get mad at him. We're going to find a way to accuse him. Now, that seems completely ridiculous to us. Like, today, Christians don't get angry about trivial things like that at all. Sense the sarcasm. But we need to put ourselves in a Jewish culture to understand why this was such a big deal. In the Jewish world, in the world in which Jesus lived in, they were in captivity under Roman rule. And the reason that they were in captivity was because their people, the Jews, the Israelites, could not obey the laws of God. And it kept getting them into trouble over and over and over again. So by the time Jesus comes on the scene, they are hyper-legalistic about following the law. And anything that was in the law, which is our Old Testament, they made sure that they didn't even come close to messing up. Because they were so afraid, if we mess up, we're going to get in worse. Like, we're under Roman law now, but if we don't follow this to a T, we're going to get in even bigger trouble. And they were so concerned about it that they created all these extra rules to go along with the laws. Specifically, the law they're concerned about in this story is the Sabbath law. And we get it from the Old Testament, from the second book of the Old Testament, Exodus, which is tells us the story of Moses. And God gives Moses the Ten Commandments. I want to show you one of the Ten Commandments, the one that gives us this idea of the Sabbath. Look at it with me. It's going to come on the screen so you can follow along in YouVersion. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So that is the law that God gave, that God said, hey, listen, you are to work hard 6 days, and you are to budget your time accordingly in 6 days so that you have time to have a Sabbath on a seventh day. And the Sabbath for the Israelites, for the Jews, was Saturday. Traditionally, it was Saturday, a day of rest. Now, by the time you get to Jesus' day, they had created all these rules around resting. They had defined what it meant to rest. Specifically, on the Sabbath, you could only take 3,000 steps. That was it. If you took more than 3,000 steps, you broke the Sabbath. God didn't say that. They came up with this rule. And I don't know how they counted steps. Like, I don't know if they had, like, some biblical Fitbit that, like, was powered by the sun that let them tell, oh, I'm on 2,999 steps. I better stop walking. Like, I don't know how they measured their steps. But if you took over 3,000 steps, you broke the Sabbath. And they created all these rules and all these regulations, all these things that were above and beyond what God intended for the Sabbath. Now, a quick side note about this. We have gone on the opposite spectrum of the Pharisees. That the Pharisees, even though they were wrong, they had attempted to follow God's law. They'd attempted, and they'd put a lot of extra things on it. They were following God's law, and they were adding steroids to it. Like, it was just above and beyond. But their intent was right, because the Sabbath is something that we largely ignore in our culture. And the more that we put God on a shelf, and the more that our culture kind of puts God at a distance, and the more that our culture kind of says we don't really trust God's laws or God's standards, the more messed up we find ourselves. And specifically in this idea of a Sabbath, science is now catching up with what God has wired us to do. That if you look out and read scientific journals and articles, they are pointing to that the human body, specifically Americans, are stressed to the max, and the reason that we are stressed and anxious is because we are incredibly busy. So where the Pharisees, they failed because they put all these extra things on it, we're failing because we don't even honor the Sabbath. I love what this article in the New York Times said. It said, busyness serves as a kind of existential reassurance, a hedge against emptiness. Obviously, your life cannot possibly be silly or trivial or meaningless if you are so busy, completely booked, in demand every hour of the day. What's his point? His point is that we are so empty inside and so broken that we filled our lives with busyness so that we can masquerade like we actually have meaningness. We pretend to have something meaningful going on. We pretend to have purpose because we are busy every second of the day, that every second is accounted for by doing something. And we have elevated busyness. Right now, today, if you ask someone, hey, how are you doing? They won't respond with, I'm happy, I'm content, my life is good. How does everyone respond? I'm busy. And that's a good thing, right? If someone said to you, if you said, hey, how are you doing? And someone said, man, I got nothing going on. You would say, you lazy bum, like you need to get a second job. Like you would fuss at them if they actually said that they had nothing going on. We have elevated this idea of busyness. And we are, in fact, addicted to busyness. The American Psychological Association has published its Stress in America survey since 2007, and they find that the majority of Americans recognize their stress exceeds levels necessary to maintain good health. The most frequent reason they cite for not addressing the problem, being too busy. So the vast majority of Americans are functioning at an unhealthy level because of the stress that we're in. And the reason why we can't handle our stress, we're too busy. Think about that, that you are so busy that you can't even take care of your own emotional well-being. We have abandoned the Sabbath, and we shouldn't become like the Pharisees who are saying, oh no, if you've taken 3,001 steps, you're outside of God's plan. But we should address that God knew what he was doing, and when God created us, he said, listen, if you want to function best, get all your work done in 6 days and take one day to have a Sabbath. And I'm not going to be legalistic about it. It could be a Monday, it could be a Thursday, it could be a Saturday or a Sunday, but you need a day of rest, a day not just of being lazy, but a day where you can wrap your thought and mind around your spiritual well-being. I love this quote about idleness. Idleness is not just a vacation, an indulgence, or a vice. It is as indispensable to the brain as vitamin D is to the body. And deprived of it, we suffer a mental affliction as disfiguring as rickets. And this is not from a Christian study. This is from science that is showing that our inability to rest is actually destroying us. It is having ill effects on us. And our actual addiction to busyness is actually causing us not to be very productive. Because we could get a lot more done if we would take a time out and say, God, I'm going to give you a space. I'm going to give you part of my day. I read a fascinating research study where scientists paid people to take electroshocks. They paid them a certain amount of money to get shocked. And people signed up for this. Like, you'd have to pay me a lot of money to get shocked. I would take a lot of money, by the way, if anyone's in this field. Like, just offer me something to get shocked. Everyone has a price. But these guys got shocked for money. They then gave a timeout and a transition, and they moved them to separate rooms, and they were by themselves now. They went from being in a group study all together, and they would get paid for the amount of shocks that they got. Then they got moved to individual rooms where they were by themselves. And the study changed. And now the study said, because you felt the shock, here's what we're going to do. You have an option. You can either take another shock, or you can sit in silence in this room for 15 minutes. Everyone who was a part of the study who had already felt shocks for getting paid, everyone picked getting shocked over sitting in silence in a room by themselves for 15 minutes. What does that tell us? That tells us that we're afraid to be alone, that we're so empty and we've got so much stuff going on and we have so many problems that instead of addressing it, because that's hard work, and instead of doing some soul searching and saying, God, I need your help, we've crammed our lives filled with busyness to now we are scared to be alone. We're scared of silence. And so Jesus is addressing this idea in this story that, yeah, you Pharisees, yes, you've tried to do something good because you were made for the Sabbath, that you were made to take a break. You weren't made to work 7 days a week. Not only God did that. I mean, God didn't work for 7 days. He took a day off. So why are we trying to do what not even God did? You need to take a time out, a siesta, a break. It's okay to get in the hammock today, okay? You don't have to feel guilty about it. All right? Do your work. Work really hard 6 days of the week so that you can take a break, so you can take a time out and watch what God does in it. But in Jesus' day, they had gone to the far extreme, way far extreme. And they were actually watching if Jesus would heal someone on the Sabbath. They were going to get mad at him if he healed someone, a man with a shriveled hand, on the Sabbath. Well, let's see what happens next. Jesus said to the man with a shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." That's embarrassing. Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save a life or to kill?" But they remained silent. So this is what's going on in the scene, that Jesus asks this man with a shriveled hand to come up forward, and he stands in before these Pharisees, and Jesus knows their hearts, and he knows that they're upset, and he knows that they're looking for him to heal, and if he heals, they're going to get really, really mad. And so he throws something out on them, and he says, what is more lawful, to take a life or to save it? Now, what we don't understand, because we didn't grow up in a Jewish culture, is that Jesus was actually quoting and giving an idea around what is called the Mishnah. Now, in the Jewish culture, they had two things. They had the written law, which we have, what we call our Old Testament, and they had the oral law, which was the Mishnah. And the oral law was a commentary on the written law. And for years, they never wrote down the Mishnah. It was simply commentary by rabbis of the day of the text on how they understood God's laws to work. And in the Mishnah, which in Jesus' day would have been simply oral tradition, the Mishnah says, whenever there is a doubt whether life is in danger, this overrides the Sabbath. So Jesus is going toward their culture, to the Mishnah, and saying, guys, there's a loophole in even what you're trying to do, that you have elevated the Sabbath, but our own Mishnah, our own oral law says that if someone's life is in danger, it is better to help them, even if it's on the Sabbath, than allow them to suffer harm. Now, this guy wasn't about to die, but he was quoting something to get them to understand that human life is more sacred than following these rules that were set up as guidelines for us. That yes, the Sabbath was meant to protect us, but how dare you quote the Bible when another human being is hurting? How dare you put this and say, hey, listen, I can't help them because it goes against my religion, and I'm going to let them suffer while I hang out and take less than 3,000 steps a day. And this idea is something that makes Jesus angry. Look at what the text says next. It says, he looked around at them, talking about Jesus. He looked around at them in, what's that word?
Anger.
We often think that Jesus was just this nice pacifist who never got upset, but Jesus got angry. He got ticked off, and he deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. So Jesus said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. Okay, do you see the complexity of the story? That Jesus, on one hand, is trying to break the Sabbath in order to heal someone, and the Pharisees are trying to uphold the Sabbath, and because Jesus doesn't do it, they want to kill him. Do you understand how just crazy that is? That Jesus is elevating human life and saying human life is incredibly important. In fact, human life is so important that if you see someone hurting, even on the Sabbath, you should help them. You should stop taking a rest, even though that's important. You should make it a priority to help them. And because Jesus responds that way and heals the guy with the shriveled hand, they walk away and say, we want to kill you. That is totally messed up understanding. The Pharisees are angry because Jesus heals on the Sabbath. And Jesus gets angry because they put religious practices over helping people. Now, we need to wrestle with this. Because if this is something that truly does tick Jesus off, and if you're here today and you would say that you are a follower of Jesus, that you are a Christian, then this is the type of stuff that should tick you off as well. What do we get upset about? We get upset about sitting in traffic, and we get upset about someone not doing something the exact way that we would want it to be done, and we get upset when our sports teams lose. We get upset about selfish things that don't make a difference in the world. Jesus got angry, and his anger changed the world. Jesus' anger makes the world a better place. Here's a question I want you to wrestle with. What does your anger lead to? Because anger is not a sin. Anger is an emotion, just like laughing or crying. It is what you do with your anger that it becomes a sin. And when your anger is simply about things that affect your life and aren't for the betterment of other human beings, your anger is misplaced. And Jesus gets angry about something. He gets angry because these Pharisees are valuing a law over another human being's life. I love the quote by Philip Yancey. He's an author and an incredible writer. He says, Christians get very angry towards other Christians who sin differently than they do. Christians get very angry towards other Christians who sin differently than they do. Isn't that the truth in churches? If you were to go around and survey Christians, what do we get upset about? We get upset about sin, but it's not our sin. We get upset about other people's sin, about what they do. I remember when I was in college, I was hanging out with a good friend, and this friend lived a story that was a story of grace and redemption. Specifically, his first year of college, he got someone pregnant out of wedlock who was also married. So there was a lot of drama. There was a lot of just chaos and a lot of just trying to figure out this mess, and a lot of stuff happened. And he went through a journey of a few years of not living for God and not following God, and then God called him back, and he was now at the same school that I was, getting a degree to become a pastor. And one night I was hanging out with him, and that week, a pastor that is pretty predominant, Charles Stanley, is a guy, he's on TV and he's been around for a long time. Charles Stanley's wife filed for divorce, and we didn't know the whole backstory. We don't know why she filed for divorce. We don't know anything about it. We just know that she filed for divorce. And he brought it up and asked my opinion. We were kind of talking about it, and I said a few things and said, well, what do you think about it? And he said, this guy has no place being in the ministry. If he can't take care of his family, how can he take care of the family of God? And I was like, huh? And I was too polite and too nervous and too afraid to bring up what I really wanted to say. But what I really wanted to say in that moment is, how dare you? How dare you receive God's grace and say it's okay for you to go back in the ministry and yet cast stones at someone that we don't even know their full story? Isn't that what we do, though, as Christians? Don't we put a blind eye and want grace and forgiveness for our sin, but when someone else's sin, it riles us up? I can't believe they did that. I can't believe they went there. I can't believe he said that. Oh, I am so ticked off. Look at him. Let's post about it on Facebook. Let's talk about how bad they are. We get so riled up about other people's sin. I think that in this story, the thing that we really need to wrestle with is that Jesus got ticked off, not about sin, but about people who were valuing a law over a relationship. And as Christians, there's a lot of this going on in our culture today. That there are a lot of Christians who are outspoken about certain people who sin and who live a different life than what we feel is comfortable with. And instead of embracing them and saying, hey, listen, we may disagree. We may not be on the same page. We may have different conclusions, but I want you to know I still love you. Instead of embracing them, we've held up signs and said, you're not welcome. Your sin makes me feel uncomfortable. I'm glad God's good with my sin, but I'm not good with your sin. And we've elevated rules and laws and things that we found in the Bible, and we've used it to ignore that people are actually hurting in our world. If you want to know what ticks Jesus off, it's when we get focused on things and we overlook the fact that there are humans who are hurting in our world. And we're so focused on being right and having a right theology and a right understanding of God that we use that to hurt another human being. That ticks Jesus off. Does Jesus want us to accept every belief of everyone? No. Jesus has standards. In fact, his heart breaks when we sin. Jesus wants us to live and obey him. But when someone doesn't live up to his standards, anger is not the answer. Our heart should be like Jesus's. And when you see someone who is living in a sin that makes you feel uncomfortable, your response should be compassion. Your heart should break. Because someone who's not living under God's standards, they're missing out on God's best. And when Jesus looks at them, his heart breaks. You are missing out on the best, on the way I've created things, the way that I've designed things. You are affecting your life, and my heart breaks for you. I'm not angry at you. My heart breaks for you. And as Christians, we need to have a heart after Jesus. We need to have a heart that breaks when people live and do things that we would consider to be sin. Raising a fist and getting angry at someone for breaking God's laws doesn't solve anything. Think about it in your life. Have you ever changed your life because a stranger came up and yelled at you? Have you ever have you ever just said, you know what, you are so right. Thank you for trolling me on the internet and telling me what an awful person I am. I was blind to my own sin, but now since I don't know you, stranger, thank you for commenting and telling me how negative and how bad. That just doesn't work, does it? You know what does work? When you embrace someone that you disagree with and you love them to Jesus, that works. And if you want to tick Jesus off, elevate someone else's sin and cast stones at someone else's sin and forget about the fact that you are called to be salt and light in the world and you are called to make a difference. I want to give you some application today, and the application is simply this. This is what you do with what you've just heard. It's pray and ask God to break your heart for what breaks his, and then look to change the world this week by helping those in need. Pray and ask God to break your heart for what breaks his, and then look to change the world this week by helping those in need. I want to tell you why this is such a serious topic to me and why this hits home. Because I've grown up in the church, and in the church world, what I've experienced is that whenever someone sins, because it's awkward and because it's messy, we just want to get rid of them and just erase the problem and just pretend that they didn't exist anymore. And what I experienced, I remember my 10th grade year, my youth pastor, who I was really close with, sinned. He made a mistake. And instead of telling us students about it, they simply swept it under the rug, and literally he disappeared. We showed up for a ski trip, and he wasn't there. And they didn't give us an explanation, and they wanted us to be okay with it, that our youth pastor wasn't there. But I was close with my youth pastor, so when we got back from the ski trip, my youth pastor called me. I'm a 10th grader. And my youth pastor calls me, and he says, "Rob, give me a reason why I shouldn't drive my car into a tree right now. My life is over. Every person that I thought loved me, every person that was a friend of mine, has abandoned me. And I'm not even welcome to come back to the church that I call my family. Why shouldn't I take my life, Rob?" As a 10th grader, I had to wrestle with who I considered one of my best friends, my youth pastor, someone that I looked up to. Not only did he sin, but now he wants to take his life because there's no place for him. As long as you're following all the rules, you're welcome in church. But as soon as you abandon one of the rules and make us feel uncomfortable, we're going to kick you out and pretend that you don't exist anymore. And in that moment, I had to tell my youth pastor, "Don't you dare drive your car into a tree. I look up to you. I respect you. Even though you messed up, I need you to keep going. I need you to influence me. I need you to be strong. I love you despite the fact that you've messed up." And Next Level Church will never be a perfect church, but it will be a church where messy people can come and get to know other messy people. And it will be a place where we can bring our sin and our junk, and we can be honest with one another and say, "I screwed up. I messed up. I sinned. I know it was against God. I messed up." And the church should be a place that says, "You can't scare me away, because my sin doesn't scare Jesus away." Does that mean that we have to like it every time someone sins? No, our hearts should break. Does it mean that we can't have difficult conversations? No, sometimes you need to have a hard conversation with someone and in love say, "Hey, listen, you are breaking my heart. You are making a decision that is not best for you, your friends, and your family. But I want you to know that no matter what you decide, you can't shake me." We need to be a people who loves people through their sin. So this week, would you take some time to pray and ask God to break your heart for what breaks his? Because apparently, according to this story, Jesus' heart wasn't broken because people sinned. His heart was broken because people were trying to uphold the law over taking care of someone's needs. And as a Christian, I want to get ticked off out of what Jesus gets ticked off about. I don't want to get ticked off because you've sinned or you've messed up or because you've done something that makes me feel uncomfortable. I want to learn to love you even through the mess. Would you guys pray with me? God, we just come before you right now. And we admit that we're imperfect and that we're a mess. And we ask, God, that you would give us a heart for those that are also messy, and that we would have a heart for, God, the broken. And we ask, God, that this would be a place where messiness could occur, but that we would find some healing and some hope through a relationship with you. We ask, God, that you would just do what we can't do on our own, that you would change our hearts, that you would give us a desire to live for you and to love you. And God, would you break our hearts for what breaks yours? This week, would you help us to see those that are hurting? And we can't fix every need. We can't be a savior, but God, we can point them to you. So would you give us opportunities to truly love people? Would you help us this week to live like you? In Jesus' holy name, amen.
We hope you've enjoyed and learned from today's podcast. If you'd like to connect with us further, you can check out our website, nextlevelchurch.net, or find us on Facebook or Twitter.